In association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. It's time for part two of our conversation with Ed Brubaker. And as usual, it's time for that random portion of the conversation when we talk about our favorite crime films and television and some things that are on Ed's mind in terms of looking back at some Golden Age and Silver Age creators and stories. Plus, more of your listener questions, including a comparison of Ed's collaborative years with Greg Rucka on Gotham Central and with Matt Fraction on Uncanny X-Men and Iron Fist, all coming up on this edition of Word Balloon. Before we get started, a couple notes of things coming up. For example, the New York Comic Con is this weekend, and I'll be there roaming the aisles. In addition to recording some Word Balloon interviews, we'll also be doing our best to get a live interview with Art Balthazar and Franco Aureliani, the creators behind Tiny Titans, Billy Batson and the Magic of Shazam, and the soon-to-be writing team of Young Justice, the DC comic book adaptation of the Cartoon Network series. All of that is for our Aw Yeah podcast with Art and Franco. If you haven't been listening, it's available on the Word Balloon Network. You can find their RSS feed at awyah.libsyn.com. We've got the petition to iTunes to get them listed in the iTunes podcast series. And of course, as usual, iTunes takes its sweet time. So until then, the best ways to get it is you can hear it on our site at wordballoon.com, or better yet, go directly to their website where all the episodes are posted. That's awyah.libsyn.com. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by InStock Trades. You'll see InStock Trades not only at their website, InStockTrades.com, but this weekend at the New York Comic Con, where they've got a very big announcement happening. Don't forget, 37% off the standard retail price on DC, Marvel, and Image product from InStockTrades.com. Dark Horse up to 42% off InStock Trades. We're talking to Ed Brubaker. It's a great chance to catch up on your Ed Brubaker trades or hardbacks if you go to InStockTrades.com. The Incognito trade retails at $18.99, but at InStockTrades.com, it's just $11.96. But if you really want to do yourself a favor, splurge on the Criminal Deluxe Edition. $49.99 is the standard retail price, but at InStockTrades.com, they trim it down to $31.49. And don't forget about their sister site discount comic book service, DCBService.com, for all your monthly pre-order needs. Check out all the details and look at all the great books from Ed Brubaker waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. All right, let's get back to the listener questions for Ed Brubaker on part two of this edition of Word Balloon.
I want to come back to a couple more questions from the Peanut Gallery. Ken Ochalek asks, I'm getting the wrong person here. Hold on. This is from Scorpio Steel.
You have like a regular person, and now you have Scorpio Steel.
Yeah, that's, well, you know.
Really? Well, I mean, no one's going to compete with Vampire as a last name. I'm just imagining that Vampire is actually that person's last name in real life.
I'm Fred like Vampire. How you doing?
Yeah, well, one night, Matt and I were joking around when we were all on the 360. This is like years ago now, because I haven't done the late night 360 Call of Duty stuff for years.
No? Okay.
No, I think until a new Call of Duty comes out, and everybody has more kids now, so it's rarer and rarer for them to find the time.
Oh, that's too bad. All right.
But, yeah, Matt and I were joking around one day that Spider-Man had always been mispronounced, and it's actually Spider-Man.
like Saul
like
Spider-Man.
Spiegelman.
Yeah. Spider-Man,
know?
Hello.
Spider-Man. What? And then Matt, like, at some point in between, like, shooting people, managed to get online and find out that there's actually a guy named Peter Spiderman who lives in Forest Hills, Brooklyn. So, like, that's where Peter Parker lives. And I was like, that guy should really work at Marvel. Pete Spiderman. Like, what a name of that. So the idea that someone's last name is actually Vampire would be really funny.
I asked Marv Wolfman.
That is Vlad Vampire, sorry.
I asked Marv Wolfman. I said, wasn't it inevitable that Marv Wolfman would be writing Werewolf by Night? And he's like, no. I'm like, all right, clearly I got you on a bad day. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no.
Sorry. See, he was not going for it. I'm like, all right, no. Moving on, sorry.
I swear to God, as a kid, it never even occurred to me to see Marv Wolfman, and I'd be like, that's a made-up name. But I also think Peter O'Toole is the best name for a porn star ever.
Indeed.
Yeah.
I'm with you. Well, Scorpio Steel asks, will we ever see any of the characters from Purgatory USA or Low Life appear in Criminal or Incognito, or perhaps even a peek into their lives in a different title? Surely Tommy could meet Leo or Tracy, Or is Tommy Booker from Low Life actually Tommy Patterson from Criminal, and thus Leo's father prototype? You don't get enough credit for your early books, I tell you.
I think I know that guy. I think that guy that name sounded familiar to me. I think that's a guy who I met in the early 90s who did a comic for Caliber, actually, that was like a kind of a cool autobiographical comic. That's funny. No, none of that will ever happen. But I think I got an email from him telling me he'd changed his name to Scorpio Steel, which I thought was really funny at the time.
It's a good name.
But I think he also, if it's the guy I'm thinking of, I think he's married to a girl named Jean Grey.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Hey, PV wants to ask, because we usually talk about it, what's the best crime or noir film you've seen lately? Have you seen The Square?
Yeah, I saw The Square like a year and a half ago.
What'd you think?
Oh, I loved The Square. The Square is awesome. It's funny because I've been going to visit my dad a lot lately, and my wife and I took him to see The Square because my dad and I would always go see movies growing up. But when I was growing up, and he just, you know, it was one of our things. We'd go to the comic store, and then we'd go to the movie theater, and he would take us to completely inappropriate movies. I actually did a comic about it once that he made a deal with my brother and I when my parents split up. He got us for the weekends, and Saturdays we could pick the movie, and Sundays he'd pick the movie. And you know, he took us to see like The Devils, and you know, he would take us to R-rated movies, and he would just like say, okay, well, I want you guys to know going in, this movie's gonna be a little bit violent. It's gonna, if anything disturbs you, just let me know, and we'll leave. And
how old were you?
9.
Okay.
I remember when I was 8, and they took us to see Tommy because they thought we'd like it because it was about rock and roll.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, that was. It's surprising I ever ended up liking The Who after that.
Yeah, Ken Russell's a little tough for a 9-year-old.
Yeah,
that
Ken Russell, you know. But I grew up going to see Ken Russell movies, you know. So, but you know, and I think my dad not having any kind of censor for, you know, any kind of boundary for what was okay to show a kid, because he just figured if he talked to us about it afterwards, it was fine, which it usually was. But I think between that and my mom like raising us, dragging us to her AA meetings, is possibly where I ended up becoming a writer. but yeah, so I took my dad to see The Square thinking, oh, he's gonna love this, and I hadn't seen it in, you know, a year and a half. I saw it when it was up here at the Film Fest.
Okay.
In 2009, and I forgot how tense it is, and my dad has been not doing so well health-wise, and so I, you know, it's starting to get, it's a pretty gruesome movie, and I was a little bit worried about him, and he and his wife would just talk to each other, and, boy, that guy doesn't make any good decisions, does he? And, you know, and they're talking, it was a matinee, and there was only like 6 people there, but I was just like, wow, you guys are talking like you're in your living room. And then, you know, the next day, he wanted to go see the girl with the dragon tattoo, which it turned out he'd already seen, and they both wanted to see it again, him and his wife. And my dad is in his 70s, and she's got to be in her late 60s. And like, have you seen that movie?
I have not seen that movie yet. No.
Well, the first, you know, huge spoilers here. The name of the book in its original language is Men Who Hate Women.
Okay.
It is not The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. The first half an hour to 40 minutes of that movie is so fucking, like, brutal. And there's some stuff that goes on in that movie that is, I was just like, oh my God. And it's not, like, too graphic. It's just graphic enough to make you squirm in your seat and go, oh God. And I couldn't believe after my dad's like was after the Square was like, that was almost a little too much for us, that he wanted to see The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo again. Like the next day, he'd seen it a week before that, and they thought we'd really love it, and it was a really good movie, by the way. But it was one of those things where it was like, boy, they make them brutal in Europe. like you forget that, you know, I mean, American crime movies have really toned down from the 70s or so.
Yes.
When we used to have a lot more, say, brutal rape in our movies.
Sure. No, you're right.
But there's, you know, I mean, I often wonder if we could, if a movie like Chinatown could get made today, where the whole story twists on incest.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, I don't know if something like that could get made, but
that's a good point.
Yeah, so I love The Square. I can't wait to see what that guy does next. And my favorite recent one actually is by another guy from that group, the Blue Tongue guys, the Australian sort of film collective that made The Square, and they have a movie called Hesher, which I haven't seen yet, which was also at Sundance.
I'm wondering if that's the new one that's coming to Chicago that I haven't seen yet.
Yeah,
because there is an Australian crime film that I'm hearing good things about.
Yeah, Australia. It's called Animal Kingdom.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, we just saw that like a week ago.
And
that one, yeah, it's amazing. It's
cool.
It's another one of those. Like, I'm not sure I would call it a noir, but it's really a strange twist between something like a coming of age story and a noir. But it's a really sort of interesting. I've watched a lot of Australian crime stuff in the last year or so. There's a TV show called Underbelly.
We've talked about it, yes.
Yeah, and I got the second season of that. I think the third season is either about to start or is airing now over there.
Okay.
So I know a lot of the sort of crime history of Australia a little bit. I know a lot of a little bit of it, but so I sort of know a little bit about the 80s and 90s. You know, like the way crime and police corruption and all that stuff actually went down in Australia. So it's interesting to see that Animal Kingdom seems to build from like a specific time period in Australian, you know, recent Australian history. They sort of let you know it's taking place in the recent past, but they don't tell you exactly what year. But there is definitely like a nod to some pretty corrupt stuff going on all sides of everything. But it's having watched Underbelly, I got a little bit more of that. And there's a great Australian miniseries called Blue Murder from the 90s, actually, that is actually names and is about specific people, and the guy in it who's supposed to be this corrupt cop actually never got convicted of anything and now writes reviews of Australian crime TV shows, even though
wow.
he's one of the most scandalous people in Australian criminal history.
Crazy.
So he actually reviews episodes of Underbelly that have him portrayed as a character in them.
Well,
so I mean, it's a country, you know, founded by, you know, a bunch of all our prisoners over somewhere. So it's you know, we had an article about that in Criminal not long back about from an Australian reader who actually just cold submitted an article, and I'd never published an article just by some reader who just submitted it, and it was like, I'd love to write this thing, here it is, and I read it over, and I'm like, you know, there's some cool stuff in this actually, you know, so it just, you know, turned out to have saved me some time too, because I was like, wow, this issue needs to go to press soon. But Sean did some great illustrations for that one too, because he talked about just a variety of sort of Australian neo-noirs.
Yep. No, that was cool. I remember that very well. What about
that was a good article.
What about Limits of Control, the Jarmusch film from last year?
I have not seen that yet.
Oh, I
like everybody who's in that.
You know, man, I had never seen Paz de la Huerta before. And I got to say, she's much more attractive with horn-rimmed glasses than without. But regardless, holy shit.
Isn't she, like, naked in every scene in that
yes.
movie?
Yes.
Except for the horn-rimmed glasses. It's really hard
yes.
to judge someone.
Yes. No, she's stunning. She's stunning. But I really liked it, and I was hoping you had seen it, because I know a lot of people who didn't like it.
I talked to a friend of mine who said it was as if David Lynch and Jim Jarmusch had got together to make a movie.
Very much so.
Like, it was as slow as a Jim Jarmusch movie, but as hard to understand as a David Lynch movie. And I thought, that sounds like it'll either be my favorite movie or my least favorite movie.
I found it fun to go down the road. I don't know if I necessarily need to see it again, but I still...
Is it even available?
It's been on HBO. It was on HBO
oh,
this
okay.
weekend.
Oh, shit. I gotta tee about that.
But yeah, because, yeah, I came into it like 20 minutes in, and it was one of Paz's scenes.
Yeah.
And I'm like, holy shit. And then I'm like looking to see if it was going to be on at another time of day, because it was on like it's Saturday afternoon on HBO Signature.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, this looks really cool. But then, yeah, I read it got like a 42 on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, wow.
42%. So, yeah, I'm like, all right, that's enough.
That's not good.
Well, no.
That's not good at all.
Well, that's true, too. But, you see, and I kind of took it as, well, there's a few people that liked it.
Is that an aggregate of people, or is that critics? Because I tend to look at, like, the ones where they're just the, like, paid critics, because I feel like that's the one thing that I don't like about the Rotten Tomatoes, is just, like, anybody who goes and sees a movie. I mean, most of the people who are going to go on a site to review some movie that they just went to are people who hated it.
That's a good point.
Be like, I love that movie so much, I can't wait to go on Rotten Tomatoes and talk about how much I loved that movie.
Well, that's the thing. I saw enough positive...
Rotten Tomatoes.
Well, that's the thing. I saw enough positive ones and then heard from Jarmusch fans. And some of my friends who are big Jarmusch fans hated it, and others that weren't, that were Jarmusch fans, loved it. So I'm like, all right, jury's out. I'll check it out.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. I gotta go look at that one. One thing, I went through a big phase of buying foreign crime movies that are unavailable over here.
Okay.
And the most recent favorites are there's a movie called 36 that is being remade right now by, I want to say, Martin Campbell.
Ooh.
And
Layer Cake, Martin Campbell.
He made Edge of Darkness and.
Did he do Layer Cake?
Casino Royale, right.
What was the second one? Edge of Darkness?
Casino Royale.
Casino Royale. Oh, okay, because I thought he did Layer Cake, too.
No, that's
that's Guy Ritchie's partner, and I forget his name.
Yeah, Matthew Vaughn.
Yes, Matthew Vaughn, of course.
Yeah,
that's right.
No, this is Martin Campbell.
Yeah, Casino Royale, you're right.
And GoldenEye, didn't he? The good James Bond movies.
But
he's remaking this French movie called 36 that... I got it because someone on Amazon UK said it is the French version of Heat, and I was like, well, I will watch that. And it stars Gerard Depardieu and Daniel Auteuil. I never know how to pronounce his last name, but who are, you know, two of the, they're like the Pacino and De Niro of France, basically. And it is so much different than Heat that I can't even tell you. Like, it is I love it, but I could see why people might hate it, though obviously it's being remade and is, I'm assuming, going to be a pretty big movie. But it's interesting because it starts out being about two criminals and then a group of criminals who are pulling down these awesome armored car heists. And then it turns out the movie is really about these two cops who are, you know, the two stars of the movie who are vying for the same job. And it becomes this thing about political gamesmanship within the police department, and it becomes almost something like The Shield in a way, but on a much more contained kind of thing. So it's got three or four different storylines all twisting around in it. And the thing is, the guy who wrote and directed it is a French actor who was actually a cop for like 20 years in Paris before he became a writer and director. And you would recognize him if you saw him in stuff. This guy, Olivier Marchal. And but this movie is probably like the most melodramatic crime movie I've ever seen in my life. If there's like a way to do a scene as like more dramatically, it's done that way. Like it's really like nothing happens that's subtle in it whatsoever, and yet for some reason it all just works perfectly, because it is the tightest, most tense sort of driven thing, like, and you're just a passenger on this thing, and it's really cool. It's a really tightly wound little movie.
Cool.
That feels really big.
36.
But by the time you're done with it, I don't even know if it's, you know, 2 hours long. It's probably like less than 2 hours long, but it's so tense. And that one was great. And then the trailers are already out for the remake of this one. It's like the next Paul Haggis movie, and I can't remember what it's going to be called over here, but the French version is called Anything for Her, and it's about this woman who is going to do 20 years in prison, and her husband, who's like a school teacher, decides that he has to break her out of prison because she's innocent. And it is probably the best thriller that I've seen in years.
Cool.
It is, like, I've seen it now like three times. I've showed it to other people, and nobody can leave the edge of their seat. They're just so tense throughout this whole movie, and it's really cool. And in the French version, Diane Kruger actually plays the wife, and the American version is, I think, Paul Haggis wrote and adapted it and is directing it, or directed it already, and Russell Crowe is going to play the husband, and I think Elizabeth Banks is the wife, and you could see this being a really great Russell Crowe role, actually.
Okay.
Because it is a really meaty, it's pretty amazing, actually. But that one, yeah, anything for her. So, like, that's on Amazon UK. You can buy the subtitled version.
Cool.
But, yeah, those are my favorite recent crime movies, probably that and Animal Kingdom.
What was the Michael Caine movie that you compared to Gran Torino and said was much better? Wasn't that you?
What's that called? Is it Michael... what is that called? Harry Brown.
Harry Brown.
Yeah, Harry Brown was basically everything I wanted Gran Torino to be.
I was so
disappointed with Gran Torino.
There's
things I really like about Gran Torino, but ultimately, I really wanted Clint Eastwood to go kill a bunch of guys in that movie.
I understand.
And they more than deserved it.
Sure.
I mean, yes, he managed to make sure they all got, you know, all their lives were ruined, you know.
Right.
And it was a neat twist on it, but, you know. I mean, my favorite Eastwood film is always going to be Unforgiven, and it would be so awesome for him to do, you know, and I guess, you know, he claims that's his last movie as an actor, so that was his swan song, and there are some really great things about that movie, but, you know, ultimately, you know, after, you know, I mean, Get Carter is one of my favorite movies, so to see that Michael Caine back.
Yes,
you know,
I agree.
Like, this is the Michael Caine with murder in his eyes, you know, Michael Caine, and, you know, yeah, I loved that movie. I thought that was just so amazing.
No, I'm glad you said something, because, yeah, I grabbed it on your recommendation, and yes, and it's funny, because I just saw the, I think Turner Classic Movies last week showed Get Carter.
Oh, yeah.
The good one. Because, unfortunately, every time it flashes on one of the encores,
yeah,
of course it's the Stallone one.
Stars or whatever, it's always Stallone. You know, and I can't remember who directed that. That's, like, somebody pretty good, too.
Yeah, you're right. And I can't either.
And that script is written by, I won't name anybody in case I get the name wrong, but I think it's Brian Helgeland who wrote the Get Carter remake. But that doesn't mean anything when you see someone's name on a screenplay for a movie. I think there's generally a lot of rewriters whose names aren't used.
Yeah, that's so, unfortunately,
you know,
something
because
I'm...
Because someone's name is on a script doesn't mean they're the one who made it bad.
Oh, I should mention, because you'd appreciate it, at the Wizard Chicago show, which is a shadow of its former self, but still a great flea market show, I grabbed a 67 edition of His Name is Savage with the Lee Marvin cover.
Oh, wow.
And it's in mint condition, and I got it for $25, and I can't believe I got it for so cheap.
With the Lee Marvin cover.
Well, come on, that's what it was.
Yeah, he looks exactly like Lee Marvin.
You know, I mean, and it's not, I forget who painted
that. I haven't seen that since Gil Kane published it.
He published it, and he did the interiors, but he didn't do the cover.
Oh, really?
No, it's some other artist that did the cover, and it really is this great, pulpy, beautiful painted face that clearly is Lee Marvin at point blank, and obviously Kane said that was his inspiration for the story.
Yeah.
But
I mean, how great would it have been if the comics community, if the comics industry, the way it is now, you know, with all its warts and all, with its events and everything, it still has a bigger voice for creators, you know, now than it ever has, really. More good stuff is coming out that are just original creations by people who own these things or own a piece of them than, you know, has ever been in the sort of commercial realm of it. And how great would it have been if it was like that in the late 60s for guys like Barry Smith and Gil Kane and, you know, I mean...
Even Kirby.
Imagine if Gil Kane had a whole run of time of actually being able to just do crime comics, how cool that would be.
Yep.
To have grown up on that stuff. Like, I'm always so jealous of the guys who grew up on Johnny Craig EC comics.
Hell yeah.
You know, and it's like, I mean, I grew up on them, you know, from my late teens onward. But,
sure.
You know, to have experienced Johnny Craig and all that weird EC stuff at like a... I mean, that's why you grew up to be Stephen King, I guess. your mind is warped by, you know, by the comics Dr. Wortham didn't want you to read. But, you know, how cool would that have been? There were so many great guys back then. I mean, the best Gil Kane stuff you're ever going to see that was published. Well, I mean, from a personal standpoint, I love the Spider-Man comics he did, where he was inked by John Romita. I don't think either of them ever looked as, you know, Romita never looked as dynamic as when he was finishing Gil Kane stuff, and Gil Kane never looked as pretty as when he had John Romita making all the girls look pretty.
Yes, very true.
but you know, you go, if you really want to see Gil Kane cutting loose, you go and you look at, you know, the weird stuff him and Roy did on Thor when they were just basically doing, you know, The Ring, or you look at, you know,
Black Mark,
or you know, John Carter of Mars when he got to draw stuff that wasn't superheroes. I mean, this is the thing that you know we don't talk about a lot, is a lot of these guys didn't want to draw superheroes. I mean, John Buscema is one of the biggest names from comics from the, you know, 60s through the, you know, 80s.
You bet.
And he hated drawing superhero comics. He drew more issues of the Avengers than Brian Bendis has probably written. And, you know, and he hated every one of them, I think. He only wanted to draw, like, Conan and stuff like that.
Yep.
Like, he liked the Silver Surfer because it was weird space opera stuff. But he, you know, he would have, you know, just as soon drawn romance comics or, you know, or... I mean, he loved drawing Conan. Apparently, that's why he did so much Conan, and he was in like Conan every month and drawing Savage Sword, you know. And you know, so he was churning out 50 pages of Conan every month, and you know, that was the stuff. And we don't talk about the fact that there were a lot of guys who were in that field who, you know, there were no options left. You know, from a field that had in the 40s and 50s had a lot of different things you could do. Like suddenly in the 60s. Most of what you could do, you know, you could either draw Archie or you could draw, you know, very few romance comics maybe, or, you know, or you could draw superheroes. And, you know, Gil Kane was a guy, you know, like John Buscema, who really wanted to draw something else.
Well, that's why I'm so pleased that Dark Horse and DC and Marvel are reaching back and giving us even those showcase formatted things of the monster books and the and the Conan stuff. And God, I bought from Dark Horse the Solomon Kane stories. You know, I loved all black and white Marvel and all the DC monster stuff with all the Filipino artists and stuff.
Oh yeah,
I mean, that's just gorgeous work, and you appreciate it more now than I know I do than I did.
Have
you
checked out any of those the Planet of the Apes magazines
yes.
that Marvel published?
Oh yeah,
and white ones. Yeah, that stuff. There's a whole, some crazy stuff that goes on in those. There's, like, when they stop adapting the movies and they just start doing, like, what happened after the last movie, and they get into the whole, like, some of the apes are like hippies, and some of them are, it's like Doug Mensch really going nuts.
It is Doug Mensch, and that, Ed, I swear, we're on the same wavelength, because just this weekend I was reading about the island that was, like, very King Arthur-like, and it was a Doug Mensch story, and I forget who did the drawing. I want to say it was one of the Filipino artists, and I can't remember his name right now.
Yeah, probably. Rudy Nebres.
It was either Rudy Nebres or it was Rudy Rico or Rico.
Oh.
Double R name from the.
Oh, Tommy Tallarico.
No, it was definitely ours. Two R's.
Huh.
And it was either Rico Rudy or Rudy Rico or something. You know, and I'm sorry that I'm butchering the name. My apologies.
Yeah.
But no, it was, and it's, you know, again, I've only been able to grab a few of those black and
really angry. Letter in Tagalog.
Now the Luna brothers are going to give me shit for it the next time I see.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey man, come on.
Yeah.
No, they're good guys. But no, that's the thing, and I always
there's
give
that whole on. Yeah, I mean, that's, I love, you know, I don't know if you saw me, I was tweeting about, I actually bought all the Creepy and Eerie hardbacks for like the first two or three years of Creepy and Eerie, because I had been waiting for years to see the Johnny Craig stuff. That was the only comics Johnny Craig drew, really, after
Post-DC.
DC folded.
Yep.
After they closed up shop on, you know, he did some of the EC Postcode stuff.
Yep.
Like Psychoanalysis, and you know, he did stuff in some of those Postcode books that they did, but nothing like what he did in Crime Suspense Stories or Tales of the Crypt, and you know, he's my favorite cartoonist probably, you know, ever. And you know, I love that he wrote and, you know, edited crime suspense stories and drew the main feature every time. And, you know, he was one of the few guys there who could, who wrote and drew their own stories, actually. Him and Harvey Kurtzman and, you know, like one or two other guys, actually, like, could, would write their own stories. But you know, Archie Goodwin, when he started Creepy and Eerie, like, reached out to all those guys because he's like, hey, we're basically just trying to do the ECs. You know, so come do stories for us. And Johnny Craig was like, as long as I can write my own stuff. You know, and you see the stuff, and he's experimenting with different styles. And, you know, here's a guy basically forced out of the field that he loved and sent to work over in advertising for the rest of his life because, you know, he couldn't draw comics the way comics had changed into the, in the 60s.
Right.
Archie, I think he drew some early issues of Iron Man, actually, and he just couldn't draw superhero comics the way that people wanted to see them, and he couldn't meet those kind of hardcore monthly deadlines because he wanted to pencil and ink his own stuff really tightly, and, you know, he wasn't a guy who could, you know, he was a cartoonist. He did everything except the lettering, I think.
Wow.
And, you know, and he really was a full-service shop, but he could only do about 8 pages a month.
Have you finished your article? I know you, in one of our previous conversations, you talked about wanting to do
I'm still sort of noodling away at it. It's such a big topic to tackle, and I have a feeling I'm one of 10 people who care.
I would
really like to do something, you know, like an in-depth thing on Johnny Craig. I mean, one thing I keep thinking about doing is just, you know, tackling a few stories at a time, like one, you know, one volume of crime suspense stories, and sort of going over what he did and why, you know, why I think he's so great at it. But the problem is, you know, the best stuff he did was in that about 2 years into crime suspense stories, when he just hit this role where his stories were so amazing. There's a story he did about this man and woman who are cheating on each other's spouses with, you know, they're plotting to run away together and leave their, he's going to leave his wife and she's going to leave her husband, but they're, instead of just leaving them, they're going to murder them, and so they disguise themselves as each other's spouses as they go on the run so that they can send pictures back, and they each start to actually become the person who got murdered. It's really, really creepy and existential and almost like Nabokovian or something, and it's just this, you know, like 8-page comic story aimed at children. You know, and it's like, it begins with these people murdering their spouses and ends with them about to murder each other because they have become the person that they already murdered, and it's just like, it's kind of mind-blowing that these comics were being put out. I mean, I used to work with a guy who basically was like, you know, Dr. Wortham had a point. You know, a 4-year-old should not have been reading some of this shit. And it's like, okay, maybe. But at the same time, you know, my friend's point was that and that he thought Dr. Wortham had been misunderstood because what he was trying to say was that a lot of the children reading these comics actually can't read. They're just looking at the pictures, and, you know, and they're not really taking in what the full context of it is. And I don't know. I haven't actually read the entirety of Seduction of the Innocent, and what I did read of it, I didn't read recently, so I wouldn't be one to judge.
Did you read David Hodge's book, The 10-Cent Plague?
No, I don't think I've actually read that.
Okay.
That was his analysis of the whole situation?
No, well, he of course said what a loss for that great period of, you know, experimental art and just the expression that was going on, and it was such a great, you know, the outlaw medium was snuffed out because of the pressures of these groups that just destroyed not only the work itself but the careers of so many of these great artists and everything at their peak. And, you know,
you know, that's how I've always felt about it, was just, you know, the minute you discovered that before the Comics Code, the ECs had even existed, but there's all sorts of other comic publishing companies that were publishing interesting stuff. I mean, I talked to Gene Colan about this a little, because he did, I think, 2 stories for EC, and then, you know, Harvey didn't like that he didn't follow his layouts or something, and so he... But he was off doing comics for other companies back then. And you see Steve Ditko, you know, all that crazy stuff he did in the 50s, which was, you know, I think arguably his best art, you know, maybe.
Agreed.
So there's just so much you know, there was just a broader field. And I would argue that we have as broad a field now again, finally.
Yes.
But it took a long time to get there, and, you know, it goes back to that same thing. Like, how cool would it have been if in 1968 Gil Kane would have been like, you know what, I've been drawing comics for 25 years. I really just want to do crime stuff, you know. And probably in 1968, had he the wherewithal, he could have actually started doing work for foreign, you know, publishers and doing crime comics. Crime comics were being published in Europe back
right.
then, you know. You know, Alex Toth actually was the original artist on Torpedo, and
yes.
he quit because he was freaked out by the content.
That's right. I have the IDW collection that they just started putting out
yeah.
and everything. That's terrific.
That stuff is amazing.
I understand that Kane, that it was the, you know, American publishers that got to the printers that kind of squashed his name as Savage.
Oh, really?
And really killed distribution. That's how I understand the story, and if I'm wrong...
I wouldn't be surprised. You know, I know he self-published that out of his own pocket, right?
This is what I understood, yeah. I mean,
And then couldn't get it distributed anywhere.
Exactly, yeah. So,
well,
and
that was during the period of time where most comic books were distributed by a company that was owned by DC Comics.
That's right, that's right.
And Marvel was being distributed by their biggest competitor.
Right, and that's why they were limited to, like, 8 or 12 issues a month or whatever.
Something. Yeah, they were only allowed to put out, like, 8 or 12 comics a month.
And that's why we had Tales of Suspense having Iron Man and Cap, and, you know.
It is kind of weird to think, though, that the world has changed so much that, you know, it is literally not possible to collect every Marvel comic unless that's all you plan on doing. You know, like, when I was a kid, I could buy every comic Marvel published because they only published, like, 20 of them.
Right. No, you're right.
You know, but now it is like Marvel, DC, I mean, even IDW publishes more comics than Marvel used to publish.
That's a good point.
You know, so does Dark Horse. So it's weird how our industry has changed. But you know, it is the signal to noise ratio that is the difference, and that is what we try to achieve on the. You know, when I think about all the comics that I really love, I realize I'm probably reading more comics that are you know, creator owned, as we call them. I hate that phrase, creator owned. I think people should just call it original material, you know, or new comics or something. I hate that we call it creator owned because it's like we have to emphasize the fact, you know, that most comics that we read are not owned by the people who are doing them.
True.
You know, and it's just weird. It's like, I don't, you know, you don't go out and buy creator-owned novels. You know?
No, I understand. Well, I think that's...
So I always just think, you know, when I think of European comics, most of which are at least partly owned by their creators, I don't think of, you know, when I go out and buy Torpedo, it's like, oh, here's a creator-owned comic. It's just a comic.
Sure.
You know, so I hate that we even make a distinction. I mean, obviously, I don't own Captain America.
Right.
You know, like, but... Creator-owned is not a genre, you know.
No, that's true. No, you're right.
So, but I do realize, like, every week I get my package from Midtown, and I look through it, and 90% of what I'm buying is you know, creator-owned stuff. So, and it is. But you know, I still read a lot of comics. So there's a lot of great comics coming out nowadays still.
Well, and I'm hoping that the changes, and I know we're really at the very beginning of the digital age, but. I hope that, you know, that fosters more original comics and, you know, creator-owned product that, you know, you won't have to beg for a publisher to do it. And that a lot of guys, like we said at the beginning of the conversation, with, you know, what Mark has been able to do with the success of Kick-Ass and a lot of his own original ideas. And hopefully, you know, I certainly wish the same success for you on what's going on with Incognito and Criminal. And you know, I want to ask about Sleeper's movie... prospects. Where is that these days?
Last I heard, there was a few months back, and someone was working on a script. I know, you know, that it's in, you know, it's in pretty serious development at Warner Brothers. I mean, they paid somebody to write a script. I don't know who it was. Honestly, it's
okay.
Someone who's sold a couple of hot spec scripts or something that they're very hot on. They have not really kept me involved in the Sleeper stuff. I'm friends with one of the producers through Raimi's people, so if I call him up, I can get, you know, insight on it, but I haven't really been, you know, asked to be involved in the process much. And you know, maybe it's just because it's so early on, or maybe it's because I am, you know, on contract at Marvel, or you know, and they don't want to, you know, I mean, they're very, you know, these are now giant corporations we're talking about. Now we're talking about Warner Brothers and Disney,
right?
You know,
right.
So it may be that Warner Brothers doesn't want a guy who's on a contract with a company owned by Disney involved in their movie. I don't know, but you know, I mean, Geoff Johns is a friend of mine, and I'm sure if it gets to the point where they're actually, you know, moving forward on making a sleeper movie, I'm sure they'll want me to be, you know, out on the set and seeing what they're doing and stuff. So, you know, I'm confident if it ever gets made that you know, I'll be involved. I just honestly cannot imagine how they're going to take Sleeper and turn it into a movie. Like, I'll be thrilled if they can figure it out. If they can crack that nut, it'll be great. But it's such a big story.
Sure.
You know, I mean, you could say that about Goodfellas too, which was a great movie. So, you know, maybe they'll figure that out. Maybe this will be Goodfellas for the supervillain set or something. But which is actually not a bad idea for something.
There you go. Write that down.
Yeah. Okay. Erase that part of the podcast. Yeah. But you know, maybe there'll be a way to. It just feels like such a big story that I just can't see how they would crystallize it into a movie. You know.
Understood. And one other question that came up in the, and then I'll wrap up because we've been having one of our wonderful tangent talks, which I always appreciate.
Yeah.
But well, that's a good thing, Ed. And honestly, I'm always glad that you come back because I really do abuse your time, and you're very kind.
Far too long
in
this one.
Yeah. Okay. And this is from the previously mentioned Ken Ochalek. Who asked, you've had a couple notable runs with co-writers, Gotham Central and Iron Fist. How did your personal writing process change to accommodate the style and process of Greg and of Matt?
Well, with Greg, it was different in that we both sort of broke into comics around the same time, and we were both working in the same office, and we... Gotham Central came out of Greg and I being given the assignment of plotting out the spine, which is when you're doing an event thing where every issue of the thing is going to be written by someone else, but it's going to take, you know, it's going to be one continuing story, basically, that has a beginning and an end. Someone has to write what they call the spine, which
sure.
is, here's the plot. This is what happens in your issue, basically, and you can do it any way you want, but this has to happen. And so Greg and I wrote the spine for a story called Officer Down, which had already been greenlit before I actually started working in the Bat Office. And when we were working on it, both of us were talking about how much fun it was to write cops walking through crime scenes that were dealing with the Joker and Catwoman and things like that. And at that point, I think Matt Idelson had asked Greg and I if we wanted to co-write a book together because we got along so well doing Officer Down, and the thing they wanted us to do was a relaunch of The Outsiders. And Greg and I had a few conversations about it, and neither of us were really that thrilled about relaunching The Outsiders. And we went back to Matt and we said, how about we do like a Gotham City Cops book instead? That's, you know, and we sort of pitched what the idea would be. And then it took about 2 years for them to go ahead and greenlight it, and by that point, you know, Powers had come out and was a huge success, so that was something we could actually point out and go, hey, look, you know, Image Comic doing, you know, basically the same kind of thing we're talking about doing, you know, cops investigating supervillain crime, and, you know, and so, you know, that I think Powers actually really was kind of a help getting Gotham Central greenlit. And then there was a moment where it looked like we were going to be forced to call the book Gotham Murder City, and neither of us were too thrilled about that. And then when we were in one of our Batman group meetings, Jeanette Kahn showed up, and I sweet-talked her into letting us call it Gotham Central. So that worked out. And but yeah, that book, the way that we created it was so that Greg and I would stay out of each other's ways, so that we wouldn't be stepping on each other's toes by, you know, we created a book where, you know, there were two different shifts, and I wrote the late shift, he wrote the day shift,
yep.
You know, and and, you know, and we would alternate arcs, and then we would team up for one. And when we would team up, we basically would just plot out each issue on the phone. We knew the gist of where the story was going, and so we would get on the phone for an hour, 2 hours, and sort of, you know, kick ideas back and forth, and you know, it would be a lot of conversations going, no, 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 it's not this, it's this, and, you know, and a lot of that. And, no, oh, wait, wait, no, there's a clock on the thing, you know, like, just a lot of little things like that, and, you know.
Disagreements and, or just excitement?
No,
just, saying,
you know, no, like excited, you okay. know, like, as one person's coming up with an idea, their idea is giving you a better, like, the, very
okay.
much the way, you know, good collaboration goes when,
sure.
when it's working, and so, you know, we only teamed up for 3 stories, so I think we did the first one together, which was supposed to be a double-sized issue, and then they split it into 2 instead, and so we had to write some extra stuff for the ending and beginning of the first and second issues, and then I did the next storyline, and then he did a story, and then we teamed up for the Joker story,
the
which
sniper
a lot of
story.
People say is their favorite Joker story ever.
Pretty cold, absolutely, man.
Yeah, so that one, you know, was a lot of fun to do, and that was one of those ones where we were sort of one-upping each other and trying to come up with better ideas, and my favorite Joker line of all time is still when the Joker pops out of the interrogation booth with a gun in his hand and goes, hey, it's the cops, and just starts shooting people. And I just, like, it's the cops, and just blam, blam. Like, and then Greg wrote that, which I thought was funny. I wrote very little of the actual Joker parts of that because I just didn't get very many of them. But one, I did write the where the Joker basically says, I should have taken that left turn at Albuquerque.
I just used that line
today. The Bugs Bunny line.
Yes, indeed.
But yeah, and then we teamed up for the Dead Robin storyline, which was my last thing on the book.
And my favorite Gotham Central story.
Oh, really?
Oh, absolutely, man. Well, just even the opening, Dead Robin. And it's just like, that's such a great place to start.
Yeah, what I liked is how everything always came back to something really small. Like the Mad Hatter storyline that I did with Michael, with Harvey Bullock, and the, you know, it's a school locker room of kids having been blown up, and have it, and suddenly it's connected to the Mad Hatter, and then it all turns out to be some girl who told a lie to her mom about getting pregnant and claiming to have been raped, and this whole, like, football, you know, which all came about, you know, I think it was inspired in my head by the girl with the lacrosse team thing, you know, where the girl said the lacrosse team had raped her.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Kicked out of all this horrible shit happened to them, and it turned out it was all just made up. You know,
Jesus.
Which just devalues all the times when it's stuff like that is actually true. But I just loved, like, stories just spinning out of little weird things, you know, and the idea of taking these, you know, these super villains and then mixing them in with kind of real world crimes too, and these petty little human things. And, you know, that Dead Robin story was another one of those where it's just like these little human moments that help them solve the crimes, and that was a lot of fun. But our process was really simple. It was, you know, Greg and I just chatting about the story on the phone, and then figuring out who would write which scenes, and then Greg would be typing as we were figuring that out, and, you know, 10 seconds later I'd get an email with the, you know, one sentence for each scene breakdown that we've just gone over, and, you know, these pages you, these pages me, these pages you, and then we would basically race to see who could finish their half of the issue first, because we would split it up as equally as we could get away with. Sometimes he'd have 12, or sometimes I'd have 12, and the other one would have 10, but generally it was, you know, half an issue each. And then whoever turned in their half first had to deal with pacing the issue together and making sure the transitions read smoothly.
Okay.
And, you know, and that was basically it. And we both did, like, a lettering pass after it had been drawn and everything to make sure it all read right, and, you know. But it was basically a very pain-free collaboration. And with the Iron Fist, it was also incredibly pain-free, at least for me. Matt might not agree, because he had to do a whole hell of a lot more of the actual work.
Right.
But with Iron Fist, after the first storyline, especially, I had always wanted to do Iron Fist, and basically my schedule was so crammed, and I had done this Daredevil story where everybody agreed that at the end of my first Daredevil story, when it turned out that Danny Rand was the guy running around in the Iron Fist in the Daredevil costume, was the perfect time to launch a new Iron Fist book. And I was like, yeah, but I want to write Iron Fist, and you guys aren't going to let me write Iron Fist right now because I have too much other work. And so the idea was floated for me to bring on a co-writer, and so I just called up Matt and I asked him if he wanted to co-write Iron Fist, which I didn't even know if he'd ever read. But Matt, I had been talking to Matt as he was, you know, Axel had asked me to sort of walk him through a little bit of the pitch process of how to, you know, refine his pitch for, I think, Punisher. And I don't know if I was actually any help to him at all on that, but Matt and I got along really great, and I thought, okay, well, this will be fun. And I love Matt's comics, and I think he's, you know, he's really, you know, from having spoken to him, you know, clearly into the right kind of stuff to get, you know, what basically this Iron Fist book should be. And Matt brought so much to the table. And, you know, I mean, the first arc, I kind of basically knew that it has to really be about, you know, the guy who was the Iron Fist before Danny, because, you know, we've never gotten into that too much. And, you know, he's called the Immortal Iron Fist, and there's this costume in the glass case. And, you know, that was the beginning of it for me. And, you know, after that first storyline, I mean, the first issue, I did more writing on that issue than I did on any of them. And then, you know, we would split up the work here and there, but after the first storyline, really, you know, because of my schedule, Marvel didn't want me to be, you know, spending as much time on Iron Fist as I was on my other books. And also, it was unnecessary. You know, Matt really knew what to do. We would talk about the issues over the phone, and then he would send scripts in, and I would sort of, you know, maybe trim some stuff or change a scene because I thought that it should be this way, or often because we had discussed it being a certain way, and then Matt had written it differently because he had just had a baby.
Right.
And, you know, remembered it differently, and then I was like, no, we said it would be this. And so I did some rewriting, you know, and I was definitely involved in the plotting, and, you know, there is a significant amount of dialogue in the second storyline that is actually written by me, and some of it even stuff that people think is written by Matt. But Matt did so much more, you know, like, we were talking about how to do a Kunlun storyline that would be different than, you know, the average Kunlun storyline, and I just looked at a poster on my wall in my basement. My wife had an Enter the Dragon poster, and I said, oh, Kung Fu Tournament. And, you know, it had never even occurred to me that there was a Mortal Kombat movie or three. but then, you know, then we started kicking around ideas, and suddenly, you know, Kunlun was just one of seven, you know, mystical cities of heaven. And you know, and then Matt was off and running and creating, you know, all the other immortal champions, and, you know, other than the Prince of Orphans, who Matt came up with the name for, and it was basically just our nod to the guy that Iron Fist was a nod to.
Amazing Man.
So, yeah, Amazing Man. So, who is public domain?
Yes.
But which is why our guy's called the Prince of Orphans.
Understood.
But also because Amazing Man is a really dumb name. But yeah, Matt, I mean, Matt came up with all that stuff, and Matt really, you know, did the bulk of the work on that. So, you know, I always feel a little bit bad getting as much credit as I have for Iron Fist, you know, but at the same time, I do feel, you know, kind of possessive of it in some ways, just because, you know, it really, you know, I mean, what Matt did with the book, you know, when, like, his final issue, the final issue of Iron Fist that Matt and Aja did, I didn't do anything on that issue except read it as a fan.
Interesting.
You know, I got advanced copies of it, and I'm not credited on there at all, and that's exactly the book that I always wanted the book to be. So I was so, like, pleased that you know, we had accomplished it, and we did one more issue than you know, Byrne and Claremont did. And that to me was the mark of success. We did an Iron Fist comic that lasted longer than the previous most successful one that I read as a kid. You know? And, you know, I just am really, you know, proud of all that work. But I really ultimately feel like, you know, other than one issue right after Henry was born where I wrote like half of it without us telling Marvel about it, you know, really, I was almost like an extra editor, or sort of, you know, a guy kicking around ideas. It felt much less than you know, co-writing the way Greg and I did, where we literally just divided up the work 50-50. It was, Matt was doing, you know, the real bulk of the heavy lifting on Iron Fist after the sixth issue, you know.
It was a great run, man, and I even loved Dwayne's issues afterwards too.
Oh yeah, me too. No, I'm kind of bummed that book went away.
Yeah,
I think he's one of the best Marvel characters, and you know, Kung Fu Billionaire. Like, how cool is that?
But, you're here.
Well, I will say I did write the line, "Bring me my victory wenches," which everyone thinks Matt wrote.
Fat Cobra? What was his name?
Fat Cobra.
Fat Cobra.
Which is like, Matt came up with the names for all those characters, and I think he might even have a whole like life histories written for them. I'm not sure.
I have no doubt.
But I just remember getting the email that day with all the names of the characters and just reading them. I'm like, these are amazing. Where does he come up with this shit?
Well, I think it's.
Yeah, it's funny. It's kind of amazing to have watched Matt's career trajectory. He is. I'm his biggest fan, and I really look at that as just kind of amazing how he's kind of taken over comics like over the course of just a few years.
Well, and I'm pleased that he then in turn helped Remender kind of find his way through Marvel, and now is. I mean, I think Kieran has been doing great Marvel books anyway, but I read today that he'll be coming on Uncanny and co-writing with Matt and everything. So
I just stayed on Uncanny so that I could pass the baton to Matt. I really was I had only signed on for the X-Men for 12 issues originally, and then just sort of it turned out that the people who were going to take over the book didn't show up to take over the book, and so I was like, well, I'll stay. You know, but by the time, you know, it was getting around to you know, close to Matt coming on, and I was like, you know, I'd like to go do something else for a while, and then the idea of Matt coming on to you know, co-write for an arc and then just take over the book appeared, but the only issue of X-Men that we actually co-wrote was issue 500, where we split it up 50-50 and we plotted it out all together and then split that one up, and then I think the next arc after that, Matt really did everything. I think we did some plotting out of like about a year of stories together, but Matt really ran off and did it all and did, you know, everything he was going to do.
Pretty cool.
I know my name is on about four or five of those, but I really did nothing.
Okay. Well, and that was, am I wrong? The group that was going to come in, were those the X-Men film writers that?
No, this is something else.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I don't even know if I'm allowed to talk about what it was. It would have been a really big deal if it happened. But,
I understood.
But it didn't happen. And so that was why, you know, I was just said, was given the job as sort of like a stopgap thing. And Civil War was about to start. And I thought, well, what do I do? You know, I've got 12 issues, and I thought, well, I could do this big, you know, crazy Shi'ar, you know, sci-fi thing, and that seemed like a lot of fun, and I did have a lot of fun doing that, and I like that character, Vulcan, has stayed around forever, and they've done three or four different, you know, cosmic miniseries about that dude, so that's kind of funny to have created somebody who's, you know, who's been that big of a part of Marvel's cosmic world for a while. But just giving the Shi'ar someone who's like an asshole running them really helped. You know, I thought that first Shi'ar Emperor was really awesome. You know, he wanted to destroy everything.
Yep.
Like, those are the kind of guys you want as villains. it is cool though that Matt does that, and now Kieran is stepping into the X-Men fold too, so it is kind of cool, but it's a good way to get in, actually, because there is a learning curve to figuring out how to do, you know, these monthly comics that we do. You know, it's not the same as just sitting down to write a story. You're writing a serialized thing, you know, so there's a little bit of a learning curve to it, and some of it is just figuring out, you know, if you're doing too much or too little, or how many words sit in a panel. I mean, it's stuff that, you know, you can figure out on your own, but if you're working with somebody who's been doing it for, you know, years longer than you pick that up a lot quicker.
Do you think it was more technical things to maintain consistency versus real a Marvel editorial edict of any kind?
Yeah, I think so. I think partially to sort of, you know, take somebody who you know, I don't know in Kieran's case, you know, but I know with me and Matt it was that, you know, they wouldn't let me write the book on my own, and I thought, well, Matt's great, you know, I'll bring him in. And you know, by the time we were done with issue two or so, you know, Matt had figured out anything that you know, Axel hadn't already sort of told him about, you know, the formatting or having dialogue go on too long in a word balloon, or, you know, it was just little technical stuff. But also, you know, I mean, Matt's a unique case just because, you know, he's one of the sharper, more inventive guys that you could possibly, you know, bring onto a book, you know. So, but I think a lot of it really does come down to technical stuff. I mean, there's just technical storytelling stuff that you know, instinctively you know if you're a comic book writer, but sometimes you don't know, like, oh, you just do it like that. Oh, interesting. Like, there's just little format kind of things that you can figure out ways to, you know, it's the kind of stuff you learn when you're studying, you know, people's scripts, basically. Mm-hmm. But sometimes having someone go, you know, you could say this in half as many words, you know, and then you realize, like, oh, yeah, you can. Because I always try to point out to people, comics writing is a trick. You know, you're writing dialogue that is supposed to sound like, you know, when someone's reading it, they're supposed to hear it in their head, and it sounds like actual dialogue to them. But if they read it out loud, it doesn't sound like dialogue. You know, it's a trick. You're trying to say as much with as few words as you possibly can, but then somehow make it sound natural.
Sure.
And, you know, those are the kind of things that you just, you know, you need to just write more comics and have more comics published, and you over time get that. I cringe when I go back and look at something like Scene of the Crime. There are word balloons that are just enormous in there. I look at them and I'm like, what is that, 100 words in one word balloon?
Interesting.
Yeah.
And I can appreciate that.
Technical stuff. It really helps. And sometimes, you know, I mean, I think I got a lot out of collaborating with Matt. You know, I think I came up with ideas that I wouldn't have come up with otherwise. You know, and just because of bouncing ideas around with him or looking at something from his perspective and going, oh, yeah, what about that then? And, you know, like, I think that a lot can be made from those things. I think we resist co-writing with people in comics sometimes because it is such a, everyone's sitting in their own little cubicle doing their own work, and it's, you kind of don't want to give up that aspect of it sometimes.
Sure.
to have to deal with, because, you know, I sit down and I get to, you know, be in charge. I'm the writer. I'm saying what everybody has to do. And so having to share that with somebody can sometimes suck, you know. And sometimes, you know, I've never had this happen, you know. But, you know, like I said, I got to write with Matt.
No, I understand.
You know, but I've talked to people who've co-written with people where they say it's actually harder work than just writing the comic themselves. So, you know, but it's a different process. It's much more like, you know, I would imagine guys who work in TV would be really good guys for co-writing, because a lot of what they do is sitting around and you know, kicking around ideas and, you know, and trying to top each other's ideas and spin an idea in a different direction, or, you know, stuff that is much harder to do when you're on your own. When you're just sitting in your room, you know, or your office, it's hard for you to sit there and look at an idea from every single angle and play it out, because you're not pacing around your room talking.
Sure.
You know, where I've been in some of these Marvel summits with guys like Loeb or Alan Heinberg, who, you know, have spent, you know, a decade or more in writing rooms on successful TV shows, and, you know, they are completely willing to just go, well, what about this instead, and just totally shove away the idea that we've all spent 4 hours talking about and go completely down a different path with it just to play it out. You know, I mean, we're all just talking, nothing's actually written down yet, so why not? You know, but when you're sitting there with your own comic, it's much harder to, you know, because otherwise you'll play devil's advocate forever and never actually write the thing. You'll be like, well, what if he did this instead, or what if he... So sometimes you know, I think that arguing over stuff, you end up coming up with better ideas, or batting an idea around, you end up coming up with a bigger way to do the same kind of thing or something. But ultimately, you know, comics is a very insular creative environment, and I think that's something that we all like out of it too. So I think that's why we don't see more writing teams than we do see. There's a few, but most of them come from outside comics, like Hollywood type people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, Craig Kyle and Chris Yost, you know, are a great writing team, and having been in the room with them a lot, watching them work, they're very much that kind of writing room kind of guys. So it is very much like, you know, I mean, I know each of them can write their own thing, but I think they really love that whole process of sitting there and making the idea bigger and sort of impressing each other and having a lot of fun. And, you know, I think that camaraderie aspect of it is a big part of it. Whereas, you know, at least for me, and, you know, I would think, you know, a lot of the guys I know, the sitting quietly in a room and pondering something and then, you know, churning out your 4 or 5 pages a day is really the joy of it.
And we wrap up there. We thank Ed Brubaker, as always, for his time. It had been too long in between visits, so we'll do our best to get Ed back sooner. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by InStockTrades.com. You'll see InStock Trades not only at their website, InStockTrades.com, but this weekend at the New York Comic Con, where they've got a very big announcement happening. Don't forget, 37% off the standard retail price on DC, Marvel, and Image product from InStockTrades.com. Dark Horse up to 42% off InStock Trades. We're talking to Ed Brubaker. It's a great chance to catch up on your Ed Brubaker trades or hardbacks if you go to InStockTrades.com. The Incognito trade retails at $18.99, but at InStockTrades.com it's just $11.96. But if you really want to do yourself a favor, splurge on the Criminal Deluxe Edition. $49.99 is the standard retail price, but at InStockTrades.com, they trim it down to $31.49. And don't forget about their sister site discount comic book service, DCBService.com, for all your monthly pre-order needs. Check out all the details and look at all the great books from Ed Brubaker waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. John Sutcher saying again, thanks a lot for listening. Looking forward to seeing everyone this weekend at the New York Comic Con. No panels, just walking around with the recorder, grabbing interviews as we can, and saying hello. So I hope to see you and enjoy the panels along with you and all the other events that are going on at this weekend's New York Comic Con. And then we'll bring you all that coverage starting next week. In addition, great other interviews are lined up for the month of October, so lots of fun and excitement. I think September was a great month. October continues the tradition right here at Word Balloon. John Sutcher saying thanks again for listening. Don't forget, if you need to contact me, you can do that via email, john@wordballoon.com. Questions or comments on the show. Follow me on Twitter under John Word Balloon, under Facebook under my name, John Sutcher. And don't forget to buy the Word Balloon app at iTunes. It's at the iTunes store. It's reasonably priced, just $2.99. That way you won't miss an episode of Word Balloon. Come to our website, wordballoon.com, and you can check out the archive as well. And don't forget the Aw Yeah podcast with Art and Franco. Episodes coming out usually weekly from Word Balloon. And again, they have their own app as well at the iTunes store. Check it out. The Aw Yeah podcast with Art and Franco. Very funny stuff. Thanks for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2010.